Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Somebody described North Korea to me this morning as a starvation economy with loose nuclear weapons. So in that light, what we know and what we don't know about what happens next. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 19th of December. Good to have you with us. Bearing in mind that you have to take everything North Korean with a grain of salt, we asked Marketplace's Bob Moon to start us off today with a little bit of context.
North Korea's gross domestic product is estimated to be just a tiny sliver of the size of South Korea's bustling $1 trillion economy, as little as 3% of that. By one estimate, North Korea's average official salary is equivalent to roughly $2 a month, although it's thought the thriving black market brings that up to around $15 a month. The North Korean government makes money through illegal trading, too. It's known to traffic in an international black market for weapons, illegal drugs, and counterfeit currency. 75% of the country's trade is with China, and in return for providing the bulk of food and military aid to North Korea, the Chinese are allowed to exploit the country's resources through mining and fishing. North Korea has long relied on handouts to feed its own people. It's received more than $2 million in U.S. humanitarian aid this year, even as international sanctions have been tightened over its defiant development of nuclear weapons.
So with that as a setup, we turn now to David Kong. He teaches international relations and business at the University of Southern California, where he is also the director of the Korean Studies Institute. David, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here.
Given all that we just heard from Bob, is it too much for us to say North Korea even has an economy?
They certainly have an economy. It's just functioning at a very low level. And there is an increasing amount of black market or gray market economy where people are selling their own produce in the streets. There's people illegally going back and forth across the China-North Korea border and importing food and other even DVDs. Hmm. So there's definitely an economy. It's just a very small economy.
Which implies, of course, they have DVD players there, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing because there's a lot of reports that over the last 10 years, North Korea has opened up substantially, not by any design, but simply because the central government has lost control over its provinces.
We were obviously talking about this story at our morning meeting today, and we were trying to figure out why in and of itself the North Korean economy matters. And the point we came to, and my question for you is, it doesn't matter in and of itself. It's the damage it does to everybody else on the way down, the South Koreans, the Chinese, and how it draws everybody in.
Yes, absolutely. The North Korean economy is so small right now. There is smuggling. There is some illicit activities, but it's not significant at all. But if there's any problems in North Korea, Japan, South Korea, and China all have these vibrant, massive economies, and they're interconnected with the world and the United States. And all of these countries will be directly affected if there's a collapse, chaos, etc.
Tell me what that looks like.
Well, in the worst case, there's a power struggle. There's loose nuclear weapons running around. And Japan, South Korea, and China are drawn into an extremely ugly, potentially very dangerous situation. And, of course, the U.S. would be involved as well. In a less apocalyptic manner, a general breakdown of the society just means potentially more refugees coming out of the country. It means more concern about what the government might do in response. And the North Korean government sometimes takes very belligerent actions.
What about the new guy, Kim Jong-un, the third son? Does anything change?
Most likely in the short run, it'll be a status quo, precisely because he was chosen by the senior leadership and his father because I think they expected him to be the one most likely to continue the current policies.
Is there a way that you see North Korea working its way toward any kind of real economic liberalization?
Well, about 10 years ago, the government made some baby steps towards opening up. In 2002, the government basically allowed supply and demand to set prices, although they continued to administer by fiat wages, and prices went through the roof, 1,000% inflation on things. Since that time, the government has tried to pull back on these economic reforms, and they've had limited success because the black market is there. The government control is weaker.
You know what I've been thinking about all day? You know that picture that's been circulating, the space shot of Asian countries, and they're all lit up, and you can tell that it's economically vibrant, and then you've got that black hole that is North Korea. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. If you think about all the countries in the region and what they've done with their economies, that North Korea hasn't come anywhere close to that. So it's very sad. And all that we can hope for is that over time, maybe this new leader or maybe just changes will force themselves on North Korea and it will open up.
David Kong at USC. Thanks a lot for coming in.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street today, the sad music is a coming. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Big news for Twitter today, which is sadly going to take more than 140 characters to set up. Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, the nephew of Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah and one of the richest men in the world, is taking a $300 million stake in Twitter, which is in turn raising some questions. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
The prince has been dubbed the Warren Buffett of the Arab world. Marwan Crady is a communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
He's a very unusual prince in the sense that he's a global investor.
Prince Al-Waleed owns stakes in Apple, Citigroup, and General Motors. He has a slice of Silvio Berlusconi's Italian media empire and is the second largest shareholder in News Corp. That's right, Fox. While the prince says he's investing in Twitter simply to turn a profit, the investment still gives Marwan Crady pause.
It doesn't look very reassuring for people who are worried about who controls these media to have a member of the royal family of Saudi Arabia controlling such a high stake.
And Twitter's role in the Arab world is expanding. Arabic is the fastest growing language on the service, which was credited with a large role in the Arab Spring. Although $300 million is a princely sum to most of us, it's peanuts to Al-Waleed, and his stake in Twitter is small. So many free speech advocates in the U.S. are not that concerned. Trevor Tim is at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Twitter actually has one of the best free speech policies as far as any of the social media networks go. They've been standing up to UK and US government pressure for years now. So to say that they would bow to Saudi Arabian pressure is a little premature.
For years, Twitter has grown by letting the tweets flow. Tim thinks it's highly unlikely a small Saudi investment will change that. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Look for the prince on Twitter, by the way. No luck. I don't know what that says. Anyway, the on-again, off-again negotiations over the payroll tax cut that we thought were settled on Friday are now off again. The House and Senate are, as of this moment, resolved to disagree over how long it should be extended for. It's a 2% cut that, if there is no deal, goes back up come January the 1st. But for all the arguing on Capitol Hill, do consumers know what the tax cut really is? And if they do know, what are they doing with their extra money? Sally Herships has more.
This story is not about the 99%, it's about the 2%, as in the 2% cut in the payroll tax. That tax funds Social Security. But has anyone even heard of the tax cut and how much extra money they got? I took a quick poll at New York's Grand Central Station to find out.
No, I don't.
No.
I have never heard of it.
When I finally met someone, Nicole Kindred, who knew about the tax cut, it turned out she's supposed to know about it.
So have you heard of the payroll tax cut?
Yes.
Oh, you're the first person I've spoken to today.
I'm in HR, so I handle my company's HR, so, yeah.
When you got your paychecks this past year, were you like, awesome, 2 extra percent?
No, I did not notice.
Once we calculated that Kindred got about $100 extra a month, she was pretty sure she saved it. Others knew they were spending it, not saving it. Like MBA student Lorraine Chang.
As a student, I was probably saving $100 a month. In Austin, that's a lot, so that's like 100 beers every night.
But Chang says she bought a lot of books last year. No one was more sure they were spending than Georgia Thornton, a teacher from Miami. What do you think it went on, your extra $400, $500, or $600?
Shoes.
Clothes?
Yes, definitely. I was trying to stimulate the economy, local merchants, that's where I was spending my money.
Exactly what the government would have wanted. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
I don't know if you'll remember this. I mentioned it on the show a couple of times. But back in the heyday of the financial crisis, we used to have a cliche wall around here, trite phrases that we were discouraged from using, tough economic times and things like that. Not a moment too soon. We're bringing it back in audio form anyway, as Congress gets ready to, yet again, kick the can down the road. We granted Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer a special one-time dispensation to explore where that now horribly overused phrase comes from.
When I was a kid, we played a game called Kick the Can. When somebody kicked a can full of pebbles, you ran and hid, like what Congress is doing now. Douglas Harper created a website on the origins of words. For him, the phrase conjures up an image of a kid kicking a can down the street.
He's going to come up upon it again in a few steps and have to do the same thing over again. I think that's the essential idea here more than the game.
State Department types used the phrase back in the 80s to describe stalled nuclear arms negotiations with the Soviets. But where did it come from? University of Minnesota linguist Anatoly Lieberman says the phrase might have been around for a century. I ask him, can he give me a specific date?
No, but I'm happy to kick the can down the road and hope that Michael will pick it up.
Michael is Michael Adams, English professor at Indiana University. He says the kick the can phrase may predate cans.
Who knows? Kicking the stone down the road? Yeah, it's tough to pin something like that down.
It's as old as procrastination. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The immigration debate in this country isn't limited to political campaigns or debates about the economic impact of it. To be honest, it's not even limited to this country, really. A couple of years ago, one of the biggest workplace raids of undocumented immigrants happened in Postville, Iowa. Hundreds of Guatemalans were working at a meatpacking plant there illegally. And now, 3 years later, there's a debate going on among those deported workers about whether it's worth it to try to come back to the United States. Peter O'Dowd from the regional reporting project Fronteras went to Guatemala to hear the pros and cons.
The debate begins in a Guatemalan wood shop where Jose Rodas and Marvin Gomez build coffins for a living. After each box is sanded, lacquered, and lined with silk, the men stack it beneath a corrugated roof. For this work, they earn $7 a day, hardly enough for Rodas, who's 23 and married with kids.
Para probar suerte. Probar suerte como le va uno.
I want to try my luck in the U.S. I think about it when I get desperate and there's no work.
Rodas would make the trip illegally, like his co-worker Marvin Gomez once did. In Postville, Gomez made 10 times the amount he earns here. He sent more than $20,000 to his family. He bought a car. He put an addition on his house. But Gomez spent every day looking over his shoulder. Outside of work, at the grocery store, he'd worry, is that a cop behind me? And then one day, it was. They treated us like criminals, put us in handcuffs, stripped us, and searched in unimaginable places. After Postville, Gomez spent 5 months in American prison for identity theft. And then he was deported. He tells Rodas this suffering is something he never thought about before leaving. About an hour away between the slopes of two volcanoes, the story is different, but the debate is the same. The village of San Jose Calderas is home to a community of subsistence farmers who tend to rows of cabbage and carrots. In such a remote place, it's disorienting to hear such familiar names. Anthony, Jared, Christopher. One mother says it makes sense. 19 children in Calderas were born in the United States. Nearly 130 Calderas residents worked in Postville, and before they were deported, families with small children made sure to get their documents in order. The mothers unwrap plastic bags and show me what's inside. Pristine Iowa birth certificates, social security cards, and U.S. passports stamped with a picture of a baby. Deborah Unech Pastor says she's willing to send her son north when he's 10 years old. Edwin is 4 now, and his family barely has enough to eat. Pastor will find a relative in the U.S. to raise Edwin and take him to school. If he stays in Guatemala, he most likely will stop school after second grade.
We know that we have to respond, but how? This is the problem.
Alejandra Gordillo heads a government agency for migrant affairs. She says several thousand American children return to Guatemala every year. The best place for the children is here in Guatemala, she says. We don't want them to grow up in the dirt, but we also don't want them growing up in a society that rejects them. Gordillo and the families agree that politically and economically, life will be difficult in the U.S., but it will be harder in Guatemala. So every Postville family here expects the children to go north eventually. A man I met in the coffin wood shop described this debate in Guatemala as a two-sided coin. One side is the dream, the other is the risk. And so it is in this country that you'll find government officials, neighbors, and coffin builders engaged in a conversation that never seems to end. It's all around you, says former Postville worker Marvin Gomez. So many people come back to these villages with money. You're human. You think about it. Just like coffin maker Jose Rodas thinks about it now.
If I ask her, my aunt will give me the money I need.
Give it your best, Gomez says, and don't get caught. When the time is right, Rodas will leave. Until then, he'll line another pine box with silk and dream about his chances. Reporting from Guatemala, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Coming up, when brown goes green.
Well, I've been driving for 34 years. My previous package car used to gas up every week, and now I gas up once a month.
United Parcel sustainability, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shaved off 0.8%, 100 points, closed at 11,766. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ sliced off 1.25% today, 32 points, finished at 2523. The S&P 500 lost 1.1%, 14 points, ended at 1205. Some banks headed the wrong direction. Citigroup and Bank of America each emptied their pockets of more than 4%. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew 3.75% today. Goldman Sachs unbanked 2.75%. Zynga. Zing down more than 4%. That was after losing 5% in its first day of trading last Friday. Hey, new high-growth tech companies? Anybody? Yeah, no, I didn't think so. Prices for 10-year T-notes rose. The yield fell to 1.81%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for November. Did you know the U.S. Post Office issued its first Christmas-themed stamp in 1962? It featured a wreath and candles. It was 4 cents. 1 billion of them were printed and distributed by the end of that year. That was way before email. And Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, begins at nightfall. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's going to be years yet before the effects of the financial crisis work their way out of the economy. And the same can well be said for the justice system, too. On Friday, the Securities and Exchange Commission sued the former CEOs of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for their role in the subprime mortgage scandal. They're accused of intentionally understating how exposed Fannie and Freddie were to mortgages that we now know were bound to go bad. Those losses led to the government takeover of Fannie and Freddie and a call for more regulation of the financial industry. Think Dodd-Frank. But commentator and business historian John Steele Gordon says there are still unanswered questions.
Fannie Mae started out as one of the New Deal's better ideas, a means of freeing up the mortgage money banks could lend so that more people could become homeowners instead of renters. It did exactly that for more than 30 years. Tens of millions of families joined the middle class. But in 1969, Lyndon Johnson sought to make the federal deficit look smaller. He spun Fannie off as a so-called government-sponsored enterprise. Together with its baby brother, Freddie Mac, it then slowly morphed into a monster that devoured American prosperity. By 2007, Fannie and Freddie held or guaranteed $6 trillion in mortgages. That's an unprecedented concentration of risk. What happened? Simple. Politicians prevented the proper regulation of Fannie and Freddie in pursuit of short-term and partisan political advantage. They made a fantasy, home ownership for everyone, sound like good public policy. Fannie and Freddie were, in theory, independent corporations. They were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. But real corporations can go broke. Just ask the stockholders of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. But everyone knew that the government, in the last resort, would stand behind these government-sponsored enterprises. And it did. Here's something that's vital to understand. Fannie and Freddie had their very own set of regulators, just for them. The Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight allowed them to take on ever more risk while their top executives cooked the books to ensure big bonuses for themselves. They hired lobbyists by the hundred and made large and often illegal political contributions. Banks knew they could offload to Fannie and Freddie much of the risk in giving mortgages to people with dubious credit, and they began to do so with a vengeance. Yes, the Dodd-Frank bill regulates the banks, but who is going to regulate the politicians in Washington who put their own interests ahead of the country's? The law doesn't do that at all. Indeed, Dodd-Frank doesn't even mention Fannie and Freddie.
John Steele Gordon's most recent book is called An Empire of Wealth. Write to us, would you? Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says Contact. UPS starts its busiest week of the year today. 120 million packages will be sent hither and yon by Friday. And thanks to the miracles of modern technology, UPS knows not just where each parcel is and when it's going to get where it's going. It also tracks the pollution that comes with flying and driving our gifts all over the place. That data gets bundled up and sent straight to the CSO, the UPS Chief Sustainability Officer. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro went to see how Brown is doing on being green.
Just before 9 a.m. at a Los Angeles warehouse, hundreds of drivers in brown pants load their big brown trucks with thousands of brown cardboard boxes.
Let's go, people! Let's go!
A million concerns could top the daily driver meeting on a hectic day like this. But the first item on today's agenda, gas.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Today we're going to be talking about fuel conservation and why it matters.
Don't let the truck idle while you deliver a package. Avoid left turns. Those aren't just tips, they're company policy. UPS saved 475,000 gallons of fuel last year through better driving, and some trucks help save more.
Okay, well, my name is Al Ihara. I drive the new hybrid electric vehicle. Oh, you're the one of the lucky ones, they tell me all the time. Everybody wants one.
He says they make work easier.
Well, I've been driving for 34 years with UPS. My previous package car used to gas up every week, and now I gas up once a month.
That's the kind of detailed feedback another UPS old-timer wants to hear.
Worked for UPS 34 years.
Scott Wicker became the first Chief Sustainability Officer at UPS this past March.
Started as a loader, unloader. During that time, I was going to school to be an engineer.
He worked his way up through the engineering department. That's where UPS has always handled environmental compliance. But Wicker's new job goes well beyond just following the law. In making the new CSO position, the companies asked him to push boundaries, pollute less, and get greener without losing money. Take UPS's 100,000 delivery trucks.
As much as we'd like to convert that fleet tomorrow over to all alternative fuel vehicles and lessen our emissions, they're typically about twice the cost.
He works with automakers to narrow the price gap on new technology, from hydrogen fuel cells to lighter trucks made of plastic. And he hunts for deals, buying hybrids or biofuels in states and countries with incentives. It's a race because UPS has a goal to get 20% more fuel efficient by the end of the decade. Wicker says government help is crucial.
So we've mapped out how to get there and looking at these type of projects and realizing that, you know, if we can't find a grant to match up with it, there's no way we're going to be able to do it.
Fuel is the biggest environmental issue for UPS and a huge business cost. But a CSO doesn't just save the company money. Wicker serves as a go-between with environmental groups. He has to measure things like the company's carbon pollution, water, and energy use, and then explain how UPS is shrinking all those footprints in an annual sustainability report.
If you want the detail, you click somewhere and you go into the detail.
Exactly, exactly.
Communications director Lynette McIntyre helps decide what goes in.
Data or stories or interviews or ideas.
all of that goes into this report. It becomes the way we debate issues and decide what we're going to do going forward.
There's a lot to debate. Sustainability is a wild west of consultants, certifications, and tough questions from investors, customers, and UPS's own employees. Ellen Weinreb is a corporate sustainability recruiter. It's her job to find people like Scott Wicker for other companies.
Our discipline has no roadmap to follow. The sustainability role is new, and it's a new function, and everybody is figuring out what that means for them at that company.
Including UPS.
You question yourself, what does it take to be good? How far do I have to go? What's good enough?
With few global standards and almost no regulation, he says it's hard to know where to set the goalposts. But now that sustainability is embedded in company structure, it's part of the corporate mission to figure it out. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the caveat that patent lawsuits can get really complicated really fast. Samsung is suing Apple in Germany. That in and of itself isn't so unusual. Cell phone companies sue each other literally all the time over patents. No, this case will give you something of a frowny face because it's about emoticons, those somewhat amusing but now completely played out faces you can make by typing, let's just say, a semicolon, a dash, and then a right parenthesis, and then tilting your head the right way. And I frankly forget which it is at the moment. Anyway, Samsung apparently has a patent on them. I know. I couldn't believe it either. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, this Monday. Today, the Dow off 0.8%, 100 points. The NASDAQ sliced off 1.25%, 32 points. The S&P 500 lost 1.1%, ended at 1205. Our producers include Avshai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time, back here, the mistakes of Kodak and what we can learn.
One of the things we as a country need to do is start thinking deeply about the capabilities that we want to have on our shores in the 21st century.
Our series Economy 4.0 returns. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can return for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.